Well, as you know, we this year are going through not the Torah cycle, but through the half Torah cycle. And the half Torah, for those of you who aren't aware, does not have anything to do with the word Torah. Half Torah is spelled completely differently. And it's a concluding reading from another part of the Bible. And back in ancient times, during the Syrian captivity, when it was illegal for the Jewish people to study the Torah, what they did, they got out the scroll of the prophets. And they found a section for each week's Torah portion from the prophets, something that aligned itself in some way, and they studied that. And after doing this for a number of years, it just became ingrained and it became just a regular part of the weekly readings and the cycle. So our Torah portion this week is called Vayera, and it's found in Genesis chapters 17 up through 22. And in that Torah portion in Genesis, the main thing we want to focus on is when here's Abraham and Sarah. Abraham is 99, Sarah is 89, and she's barren. And God comes and visits them and tells them, 1 year from today, you are going to hold a son in your arms, a son that comes from you too. And a year later, Isaac is born. What a wonderful story. Well, in ancient times, to go along with that Torah portion, the portion 2 Kings chapter 4 was chosen. 2 Kings chapter 4. So let's turn there. 2 Kings chapter 4. Now some of you may say, well, wait a minute. Kings is not part of the prophets. Well, in the Hebrew Bible it is. The Hebrew Bible is arranged a little bit differently than our Bibles. And Kings is part of the section of the prophets. So what we're going to do, we're going to read through the Haftorah portion, because this may be very unfamiliar to some of you, because Kings sometimes is one of those books that doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 4. We'll start with verse 1. I may insert just a few comments as we go, but basically I want to read through. Now there are two stories here. Two stories about two women. One is a widow with two sons who are about to be taken into slavery to pay a debt. The other story is about a woman who's married, but she has no children. She's barren. And the prophet Elisha, who was Elijah's disciple, Elisha visits her and tells her, a year from now, you're going to have a child. And she does. She has a son. And though, so there you see the connection between this portion and the portion in Genesis that talks about Sarah. So, here we go. 2 Kings 4, verse 1. One woman from among the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, your servant, my husband, has died, and you know that your servant feared the Lord. But now the creditor has come to take my two sons to be his servants, to pay off the debt. Elisha said to her, what can I do for you? Tell me what you have in the house. That's kind of interesting. He asks a question, what can I do for you? But tell me what you've got. You know, God tends to use the things we have instead of the things we don't have. Too many times we pray that God will give us something we don't have. Whereas God can take what you've got and bless it and make it into something wonderful. When Yeshua fed the 5,000, he didn't create food out of thin air. He took what was at hand. He blessed it, he broke it, he multiplied it, and from that little bit, he fed many. And look for this principle in your own life. Quit looking outside at what you don't have and ask God to work miracles with what you do. She said, your maidservant has nothing in the house except for a jar of oil. And the word for jar, there's just a little thing of oil, a little bit of olive oil. He said, go, borrow vessels for yourself, from the outside, from all your neighbors, empty vessels, do not be sparing. Then go in and shut the door behind you and behind your sons. Pour oil into all these vessels and carry away the full ones. She went from him and shut the door behind her children. They brought vessels to her and she poured. When all the containers were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. He said to her, there is not another vessel. And the oil stopped. She came and told the man of God, and he said, go, sell the oil, and pay your creditor, and you and your sons will live on the remainder. And that's the end of that story. So her sons were in at risk of going into slavery, into servitude. But what they needed was freedom. And so God multiplied this oil to pay the debts, and so her sons are made free. Verse 8 starts the second story about the second woman. It happened one day that Elisha traveled to Shunem. Shunem is a word that we're not quite sure exactly how to translate it, but Shunem has something to do with sleep. And it can mean double sleep or two sleepy people or something like that. It has to do with sleep and maybe the number two. And it's kind of an odd word to translate. I guess you could call it Sleepy Town. There was a prominent woman there. She wasn't poor. She's wealthy. And she importuned him to eat a meal. And so it was whenever would pass by, he would turn in there to eat a meal. She once said to her husband, behold, I now know that he is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Let us now make a small walled attic and place there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. It happened one day that he arrived there, and he turned into the attic and lay down there. He said to Gehazi, his attendant, summon the Shunammite woman. He summoned her, and she stood before him. He then said to Gehazi, please say to her, behold, you have undertaken all this exertion on our behalf. What favor can be done for you? Can something be said on your behalf to the king or the army commander? She replied, I dwell among my people. In other words, I'm content. I'm surrounded by family. We're well-to-do, and I don't need anything. So he said, and he's speaking to Gehazi, his attendant again, what can be done for her? Gehazi said, actually, she has no child, and her husband is old. He said, summon her. So he summons her again. She stood in the doorway. Elisha said, at this season next year, you will be embracing a son. She said, do not, my master, O man of God, deceive me, your maidservant. In other words, this is too good to be true. Remember Sarah, when she got the announcement, she laughed. But this woman was almost afraid to believe. Oh, don't deceive me. Don't get my hopes up and just to disappoint me. Verse 17, the woman conceived and bore a son at that season the next year, as Elisha had told her. The boy grew up. It happened one day he went out to his father, to the reapers in the field. He said to his father, my head, my head. His father said to the attendant, carry him to his mother. He carried him and brought him to his mother. He sat in her lap until noon, and then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Now, why did she do that? It's an important principle here. When you read between the lines, it tells us that Elisha summoned the woman to his room. She stood in the doorway. And it says that he was laying on the bed. So he's lying back on the bed when he spoke to her through the door and promised her that at this time next year, you'll have a son. When she loses the son that comes, what does she do? She goes back to the place of the promise, back to the place that was spoken, and she puts her son on the bed where the prophet would lie. And there are times in our lives when something just goes belly up. Some wonderful thing happens, and then it all just seems to crumble. Go back to the place where the word was spoken. Go back to the origin. That's what we have to do. She lays her dead son on the bed of the prophet. Then what does she do? Verse 22. She then called her husband and said, please send me one of the attendants and one of the donkeys so that I can hurry to the man of God and return. He said, why are you going to him today? It's not a new moon or a Sabbath. She replied, shalom. Now they may translate it as well, or don't worry about it, or goodbye. But she just said, shalom. Isn't it interesting? She doesn't tell her husband about the dead son. There's nothing he can do about it. Wives, do you ever try to get your husbands to fix something that they can't fix? See, my wife never asked me to fix something that can't be fixed. I just wonder if any of you ever had that problem where they do ask you to fix things that you have no way of fixing. Anyways, so she doesn't even tell her husband what's going on. Verse 24, she saddled the donkey and said to her attendant, "Lead and go, and do not impede me from riding unless I tell you." She set out and came to the man of God in Mount Carmel. It's about a 20-mile distance she had to cover. She saddled the donkey and said to her attendant, we read that. When the man of God saw her from afar, he said to Gehazi, his attendant, there's something going on here. She's talking to her attendant to do something. He talks to his attendant, but it's not the attendants talking to each other that makes things happen. It's the woman talking to the prophet. That is where things happen. Principle here is this. The woman is a picture of you and me, a picture of us. The prophet Elisha is a picture of God. He's God's prophet. He's God's mouthpiece. And so many times when we have a need, we want somebody to go and talk to somebody who represents God. We want our attendants to do the business. But what needs to be done is you need to take hold of God himself. You need to wrestle with God himself. You need to go directly to him to see your needs met. And then an interesting thing. When the man of God saw her from afar, he said to Gehazi's attendant, "Behold, it is that Shunammite woman. Now please run toward her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the boy?'" She replied to Gehazi, the attendant, "Shalom. It's well, peace." She realized there's nothing Gehazi could do for her. She needed to talk to the prophet. So verse 27, she came before the man of God at the mountain and grasped his feet. She was not letting go. Gehazi approached to push her away. But the man of God said, "Leave her, for her soul is bitter within her. The Lord has hidden it from me and not told me." Now this Gehazi guy, we're going to talk about him a little bit later. But Gehazi is also a picture of us in our role of God's representative, in our role as God's servant. And Gehazi, as we go through, we'll see him obeying Elisha and doing some good things. But it seems here that Gehazi didn't like it that she brushed him off to go over his head to the prophet himself. He didn't like that. He tries to push her away. The very one who's supposed to be serving God can sometimes be the one who's a barrier to God. And we need to be careful that in our lives we represent him to people, but we do not get in the way of people coming to him. And this is always the difficulty within a religion, any denomination, within a church, within a synagogue. We are there to serve God, to represent him to people. But by the same token, our very existence can be a barrier to people coming to God. We go around, we want to share God, to share his truth with people. Sometimes they'll see something in our lives that makes them think, well, that's what God's person is like. I don't want any part of it. I know of people who have driven to this building to attend services here at Beth Dakoon, but when they saw a steeple on top, they turned around and left. Because, well, steeples are a pagan symbol, and they can't worship God in a place that has a pagan symbol on top. I don't think they would have gotten much out of my teachings anyway if they had come. But people who want to know God sometimes are scared of seeing a group of people. Or I don't know if I can sit that long in a pew. Or I don't know, I feel uncomfortable in that. You understand? And it's through no fault of our own many times. So anyways, what we need to do is be humble. And when people bypass us to go straight to the source, And even though they're addressing God in maybe a way we don't think is right, or they're approaching God in a way we don't think is quite as respectful of him as it should be, that's okay. At least they're going to the right one. Let's not try to push them away and correct them. Say, oh no, don't do it that way. Do it this way. If they're laying hold of God, you get out of their way and let them do it. He doesn't mind. So Gehazi approached to push her away, but the man of God said, leave her, for her soul is bitter within her. The Lord has hidden it from me and not told me. She said, did I request a son of my master? The answer, of course, is no, she didn't. Did I not say, do not disappoint me, mislead me, deceive me? He said to Gehazi, gird your loins, take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet a man, do not greet him, and if a man greets you, do not respond to him. Place my staff upon the lad's face. The lad's mother said, I swear as the Lord lives, and I swear as you live, I will not leave you. So he arose and went after her. So here's the scene. Elisha hands his staff to Gehazi, his servant, and Gehazi takes off. He girds up his loins. In other words, he takes his robe, pulls it up and tucks it in so it's short, so it doesn't get tangled up his feet, and he starts running. And he's got Elisha's staff to put on the boy, hoping that doing that, God will cause a miracle of resurrection. In the meantime, she says, listen, prophet, I'm not leaving you. So you're going to get real tired of me, or you're going to come with me and address this situation. You gave me the son, you prophesied him, and now he needs repaired. You need to restore him. And so after Gehazi leaves, Elisha leaves and goes on with the woman behind Gehazi. In the meantime, it says, verse 31, Gehazi went ahead of them and placed his staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound and nothing was heard. So he returns, and he's coming back and meets them as they're approaching. And he returned toward Elisha and told him, saying, the lad is not awakened. Why didn't this miracle work? If Moses can use a staff to part the Red Sea and to work miracles, all kinds of miracles, why couldn't Elisha's staff bring life back to this boy? I think it had more to do with the Gehazi than it did with Elisha or his staff. I think there's another lesson here for us. Gehazi had just got done pushing this woman away from the prophet. Because he didn't like her going directly to him and going through Gehazi and going over his head straight to the prophet. Oh, but he's all fixed to go and work some great miracle in the prophet's name. I see myself a Gehazi. Because sometimes I'm more than willing for God to do some great work through me. But I don't like being overlooked when people go to God and they consult someone else instead of me, who I think they should consult. In other words, a servant who's pushing the woman away cannot be used by God to raise her son from the dead. We need to be careful how we treat people, because the way we treat people is going to determine to the greatest extent how God uses us to serve people, to serve his kingdom and accomplish his purposes. I really believe his pushing away of the Shunammite woman was a thing that interfered with the miracle being worked through that staff. That's just my idea. You can think about it. There's probably other ideas as well. They're even better. Verse 32, Elisha came to the house, and behold, the lad was dead, laid out on his bed. He entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. Then he went up and lay upon the boy, placing his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, his palms upon his palms. And that symbolism is very clear here. We were all dead in our trespasses and sins. And there are some parts of our souls are probably still dead that need to be resurrected. And the secret for life being breathed into us is we need to be mouth to mouth with God. His word needs to be in our mouths. We need to speak what he speaks. We need to see eye to eye with God. We need to see things from his viewpoint and agree with it. And we need to be palm to palm with him. Our works need to be his works. How do we do that? When we do his commandments, we're doing what God does. His commandments are a reflection of what his heart is and what he does in the world. So when we obey those commandments, it's not a way of keeping us under, it's a way of making us like him. So we need to speak his words and our words need to be the same words. We need to see the way he sees. We need to work his works. I'll tell you what, then you're alive. You'll never be so alive as when you do those three things. He stretched himself out over him and warmed the flesh of the boy. He withdrew and walked through the house, once this way, once that way. Then he went up and stretched himself over him. I don't know why he had to take two times. But the lad sneezed seven times. The lad opened his eyes. Elisha called Gehazi and said, "Summon the Shunammite woman." He summoned her and she came to him. He said, "Pick up your son." She came and fell at his feet. There she is at his feet again and bowed down to the ground. She then picked up her son and left. And that's the end of the Haftorah portion. Now, I always struggle when I try to teach this because we have three women involved. We've got Sarah in Genesis, who was promised a son. A year later, she gets a son. And then later, she thinks she's going to lose her son because Abraham takes him up to offer him up to God on the mountain. But she receives him back. And then you've got the first woman there, the widow with two sons. And she's afraid she's going to lose her two sons to slavery. But a miracle has worked for the oil, and she sells the oil, gets the money, pays the debt. Her sons stay with her, happily ever after. But then you've got a third woman, the Shunammite woman. And the Shunammite woman has no son. She's given one. He dies. He's resurrected again. How do you tie these three together? And you know what? The complications don't end there. Let's just kind of map this out a little bit, if we can. I'll give you kind of a matrix to go by to sort out these stories. Now, on the slide, you see four ovals, one at the top, one at the bottom, one left, one to the right. These represent the four women in our story. You're going to say, "Well, wait a minute, Grant, there's only three." Oh, there's actually a fourth. You don't think things are complicated enough? There's a fourth woman we have to put in here. So, let's start with Sarah. And I apologize, I have to blow these up so I can write inside these ovals. Let's start with Sarah. She's in our Torah portion this week. And we reviewed a little bit about her life. And the story is found in Genesis. And it's chapter 17 to 22. Okay. We start with Sarah. And with Sarah, I need to get a different paper out here, or else I want to completely lose track. This is so complicated, I really need to look at my notes for this part. So bear with me a second. And it is there. Okay. Now, Sarah is in our Torah portion, but then in our half-Torah portion, we want to focus at this point on the Shunammite. So in the bottom circle, I'm putting the Shunammite. We don't have a name for her, but we'll just put Shunammite. Let's compare these two first. And her story is in 2 Kings 4. Now, these two women are very much connected, even though they lived centuries apart. Sarah was barren. The Shunammite is barren. Sarah is wealthy, and the Shunammite is wealthy. Sarah's husband is old. The Shunammite's husband is old. Sarah is promised a son, and a year later, she receives a son. She gives birth to a son. The Shunammite is promised a son. A year later, she gives birth to a son. You see the connections? So, we have this connection with these two stories. But then, there's Widow B. We don't have a name for her, but I'm going to call her Widow B, which implies there's a Widow A. We'll get to her in a second. But let's go to Widow B, which is in our half-Torah portion. Widow B, which is a terrible way to designate this poor woman. But Widow B is found in 2 Kings chapter 4 as well. But unlike Sarah or the Shunammite, she's not barren. You know, Sarah and the Shunammite, they have a husband, but no sons. The widow has sons, but no husband. And she's very poor. And in this story, she has two sons, but they're about to be lost. But because of a miracle, God restores them. But to understand widow B, we have to go back and look at widow A. And widow A is found in 1 Kings. So everybody turn to 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 17. And you'll see why we must include this other widow in our story. I probably sound really weird on the recording because I keep stopping. It's because I can't write and talk at the same time, as you all who are watching this, these shenanigans go on up here can tell. So let's go to 1 Kings chapter 17. And you're going to be thinking, wait a minute, this is deja vu. This is a little weird, and you're going to have a hard time, I guarantee, keeping all these stories straight. But there's no other way to approach this than to take the entire thing together. We're going to start in 1 Kings 17, verse 10. Now, what we've been reading about so far in half to our portion is about Elisha. Elisha, E-L-I-S-H-A. But Elisha's mentor was a prophet named Elijah, E-L-I-J-A-H, as it is normally spelled. Elijah means God is Adonai, the Lord, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But Elisha means God is Savior. So let's read about widow A. 1 Kings 17, verse 10. So he, Elijah, rose and went to Zarephath, which means refining, like refining metals, and arrived at the entrance of the city. Behold, a widow was gathering wood there. He called to her and said, "Please fetch me some water in a vessel that I may drink." She went to get it. He called to her, saying, "Please fetch me also a piece of bread in your hand." She said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have not so much as a cookie, but only a handful of flour and a jug." We had some oil in it, and a bit of oil on the cruise. Sound familiar? This is during a period of 7 years of famine. There's no rain. This is why there's no food. And she goes on and says, "Behold, I am gathering two pieces of wood. Then I will go and prepare it for myself and my son. We will eat it, and then we will die." But Elijah said to her, "Fear not. Go do as you have said, but first prepare a small cake from it, or biscuit of some sort, from it for me, and bring it out to me. And prepare for yourself and your son afterward. For thus said the Lord God of Israel, the jug of flour shall not run out, and the flask of oil shall not lack, until the day the Lord provides rain upon the face of the earth." She went and did according to the word of Elijah, and she ate, she and he and her household, for a year. The jug of flour did not run out, and the cruse of oil did not lack, in accordance with the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through Elijah. The miracles are similar, aren't they? For widow B, it's a matter of filling up as many vessels as you can for oil so that oil can be sold for money, money can be given to the creditor, and your sons will have freedom. But widow A, it wasn't a matter of freedom, it was a matter of life itself. They were going to starve to death. She didn't have to go borrow vessels. For a whole year, whenever she needed flour, she poured flour out of the jar. Whenever she needed olive oil, she poured oil out of the other jar. And they kept providing flour and oil for an entire year till the rains came, the food grew, they didn't need the miracle anymore. Oh, but the similarities don't stop there. Continue on, verse 17. And it happened after these events, the son of the woman, the landlady, became ill. His illness became very serious until there was no breath left in him. She said to Elijah, "What is there between me and you, O man of God, that you've come to me to call attention to my sins and to cause my son to die?" He said to her, "Give me your son." Now, what does he do with the son? He took him from her bosom, brought him up to the upper story where he was dwelling. He laid him on his own bed. He called out to the Lord and said, Adonai, my God, have you brought harm even upon the widow with whom I dwell to cause her son to die? He stretched himself out over the boy three times, and he called out to the Lord and said, O Adonai, my God, please let this boy's soul come back within him. Adonai hearkened to the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the boy came back within him, and he came to life. Elijah took the boy and brought him down from the upper story to the house and delivered him to his mother. Elijah said, See, your son is alive. The woman said to Elijah, Now I know through this that you are a man of God and that the word of Adonai is in your mouth is true. See why we have four women in this story? Start to see the complexity here. And I don't make any claims to be able to sort all this out for you. I'm just letting you know what I've been wrestling with this week. But you see the similarities here. Woman B and woman A. You have a widow and a widow here. Yet widow A has more in common with the Shunammite when it comes to sons. Because the Shunammite's son died, was resurrected, and widow A's son died and was resurrected. But when it comes to food and miracles of provision, widow A and B have more in common. Because God supernaturally provides the food for them. Both of them provided rooms for the prophet, one for Elijah, one for Elisha. But then, as we follow this a little further, the Shunammite woman and widow B are in the same half-Torah portion, but widow A is in a completely different part of the Bible. Another thing is, widow and the Shunammite receive dead sons back to life, but Sarah and widow B receive live sons that are at risk, spared. Okay? Their live sons are spared. Now, I got about this far in mapping this all out, and then that's when my son and his wife and granddaughter showed up, and I didn't get anything else accomplished all week, because I've been playing with my grandbaby. But I wanted to put this in front of you so that at least you can begin to wrestle with the complexities of this. But let me say this. This much insight I have to this. You've got four moms, and you've got five sons. All of these mothers went through physical birth pains to give birth to their sons physically. But I'm convinced that all mothers go through birth pains twice with each child. The first time, they go through physical pain giving physical birth to this child. This is Mary. Went through physical pain giving birth to Yeshua the Messiah. But I believe every mom goes through a second labor, a second set of birth pains. And that's when she lets go. She has to detach her soul to a degree from the soul of her child. With Sarah and the widow B, it was in the fear that the sons were lost. One, Sarah feared her son was going to die on the mountain at Abraham's hand, and the widow B thought her son's going to be lost into slavery. But God did a miracle and restored them. Widow A and the Shunammite, their sons actually died. And yet God restored them. And with Mary, who went through the physical birth pains of giving birth to Yeshua, what kind of pain do you think she went through when she saw him being executed on the cross? Letting him go. And yet, just as after physical birth pain, there's incredible joy, the new life, there's even greater joy, I believe, that comes after the second labor, the spiritual labor, the internal, invisible labor pains, which usually go much longer than the physical birth pains. I think the spiritual labor pains make the physical ones look like a cakewalk. Now, I'm a guy. I haven't gone through labor. But just reading the Word, knowing, you know, the dynamics in our family and stories of your families, ladies, you know what I'm talking about. So don't think, here's the comfort I can give you, don't think that this second set of labor pains, where you have to cut the spiritual umbilical cord, where you have to see your child suffer, go through death of some sort, go through the threat of death, the threat of slavery to something or other. Don't let yourself think this is unnatural, because it isn't. It's common experience for every parent, especially for moms. So you and Compost, this will really make you think twice about having kids, won't it? You see at least the balance, the beauty, the poetry of what's going on here? Two women with no husbands but children. Two women with husbands but no children. There's a balance, there's a symmetry, there's a beauty to this, and I'm convinced I still don't have all the parts. But there's something going on here that is just too wonderful for me to hit the bottom of, to drill down to the bottom of, and to be able to teach and explain. But I want to share this map with you. And then over the coming weeks, years, you can go back and revisit this and think about these four moms. Because these moms are all pictures of us, whether you're a guy or a gal. They're all pictures of us in some way. They're all pictures of women who have to wrestle with the reality of life, of loss, of disappointment. But the good news is all four have a very, very happy ending, like we talked about last week. Robin and I were talking just a couple days ago, and we were talking about how is it that when you are going through a test, you're going through something really difficult, how do you regain your joy? And I've only figured out one way of doing that. One way of doing that. I mean, provided you're trying to live a life, a godly life, and in God's presence, doing what's right. But the only way I know of it is this. You have to take your perspective, and you have to stretch it out bigger. Something happens. When you take the perspective, this thing that's filling your vision looks so dark and so awful, and you back away and get a bigger perspective. It's like, okay, all right. This is one of the purposes of the Bible. The purpose of the Word of God is to give us an eternal perspective. Then all your troubles can shrink down. Even though you're personally engaged with them and that you feel like your heart's being torn out, you can back away, at least for a moment, get relief and see, okay, the whole history of the human race, from creation until the kingdom to come, here's me. My troubles are not unique, but God is faithful. And I can see all the wonderful things, the good things that can come out of this. At least for a moment, step back and get the perspective. This may sound strange, but the next thing we want to talk about, the time that's left to us, is about Gehazi. Early in the week, Robin said, this Gehazi guy, there's something about this Gehazi guy. And I thought, what's she talking about? But then it got in my brain like a splinter. And I started thinking about the Gehazi. And so I looked up every place where the name Gehazi is found. And it's found 13 times in the scriptures, all right here in 2 Kings. Most of them in our Haftorah portion. Let me give you a little background of what Gehazi means. Gehazi means valley of vision. Valley of vision. The word for valley is the word gay. And for vision is chazion. And you notice you take the first two letters of valley, the gimel and the yud, and there they are in Gehazi's name. Then you take the first three letters of vision, chet, zion, yud, and there they are. You put the two together, and you've got Gehazi, or Gehazi, which means valley of vision. Why is this the name for this guy? Because Gehazi is also a picture of you and me as a servant of God. And as we serve God, there's only one place we can serve him, and that's down in the valley. Now I want you to picture yourself in a valley. And when you're in the valley, it can be very beautiful, but your vision is limited by the mountains that surround you. You can only see to the limit of the mountains that surround you. Now, if you go up on the mountain, if you can get up on the mountaintop, you can look down into the valley and see the shadows there. But you're never in the shadows. When you're up on the mountain, you can see the valley and the other valley and the next valley. You can see to the horizon. And from sunup to sundown, it's always light. You're never in the shadows, but you can see the shadows. Your entire life is spent in the valley of the shadow of death, from the day you're born to the day you die. The valley of the shadow of death is not some period in your life. It is your entire life. And in the valley, there's light and there's shadows. There is joy and there is pain. You get both. And your vision is limited by your environment, by your surroundings. But this is called the valley of vision. Because into this valley, God has dropped a book, which is a source of light. And this book describes to us what the viewpoint is from the mountain. And it tells us somehow, someday, we will be on the mountain and see things from that viewpoint. But as we continue to dip into this, although we're still in the valley, our perspective is broadened. And though my physical eyes can only see the light and the dark of the valley, my spiritual eyes can get these glimpses from what it's like where it's never dark. It's always in the light, you see? So Gehazi, whose name means valley of vision, is a picture of you and me. Now, as I go through the word and look at Gehazi, he's a mixed bag, like you and me. In fact, as I went through the 13 places his name is mentioned, my head was spinning, so I made a scoreboard. And on the left, we have the good Gehazi, and on the right, we have the bad Gehazi. And we're going to keep score. We're going to see when he does good, when he does bad. Now, this is probably not real fair to him, because there's going to be 13 points in this game. His name is mentioned 13 times, so there's going to be a total of 13 points scored. The question is, how many wind up on the left side of the scoreboard for the good Gehazi, and how many wind up on the right side for the bad Gehazi? And remember, Gehazi's the same guy. He's one guy. But just like you, so many times our enemy is ourselves, and we're competing against, it's that Yetzer Hara against the Yetzer HaTov, the bad inclination against the good inclination. The war zone is the soul of every human being. This is where the war is battled out. So let's go through. We're not going to take a lot of time on each of these passages, but just enough to get an idea. And then we'll put a score here for either the good Gehazi or the bad Gehazi. Right, and let me ask you this, first of all, which side do you think is going to win? How many say the good Gehazi is going to be the victor? Oh, ye of little faith. How many think the bad Gehazi is going to be the victor? Oh my, you're a very bleak bunch, aren't you? You don't have very high expectations for this person. We'll find out here. It can't be a tie because there's only 13 points, right? So, well, the first reference to Gehazi is in 2 Kings 4:12. Now, a lot of these are passages you've already read, but let's look at them again briefly. Elisha is speaking. He said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite." And when he had called her, she stood before him. So this is good. We'll give the good Gehazi a point for that. Elisha gives him an order. He obeys it. He obeys the order to give the call. This is one of the things we're supposed to do. God says, call people. And we call them. The next time we find his name is two verses later, verse 14. Now here, Elisha, the prophet, I mean, who should like have almost like the mind of God, he asked Gehazi for some guidance, for some counsel. He said, "What's to be done for her? Now she built this room on top of the house, and she's provided these things and food, and every time I come by, I have a place to stay. What's to be done for her?" Gehazi answered, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old." Good advice. We'll give Gehazi another point. When do we ever give God advice? What you see here is a picture of prayer, where Gehazi is bringing to God's attention, or the prophet's attention, a need. He's intercessing for a need. I have a feeling Elijah probably knew good and well what the need was. But he consults his servant, lets him participate in this. Well, the next time Gehazi's mentioned, down to verses 25-26, this is after the son has died. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her coming, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Look, there's the Shunammite. Run at once to meet her and say to her, 'Is all well with you?'" So anyways, he gives Gehazi instructions. Go check on the woman. What's up? So Gehazi does. That's good. Next is verse 27. When she came to the mountain to the man of God, she caught hold of his feet and Gehazi came to push her away. Bad Gehazi. He didn't like being jumped over to get to the prophet. He wanted to be acknowledged. I went and asked her what she wanted. She said, "Everything's fine." Then she comes and does this. And you know, he gets all frustrated. And then the next one is down in verse 29. Elijah says to Gehazi, "Tie up your garment, take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet anyone, do not greet them." So he gives his staff to Gehazi, and Gehazi takes off to go. But in verse 31, Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there's no sound or sign of life. Therefore he returned to meet him and told him the child's not awakened. So it was a failure. The mission was a failure. He went, but didn't have the desired result. So right now our score stands at 4 for the good Gehazi, 2 for the bad. Go down to verse 36. Then he summoned Gehazi. This is after he restores life to the Shunammite woman's son. He summoned Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite." So he called her. When she came to him, he said, "Pick up your son." That's good. Calls her again, this time with really good news. Really good news. "Your son's alive. Come get him. He's ready for pickup." All right. But now we go beyond the Haftor portion into chapter 5. This is the story of Naaman the leper. He's a Gentile who is a very powerful general in the army, but he's a leper. One thing leads to another, and Naaman learns about Elisha and his miracle-working powers. So he comes to Elisha. Elisha says, "Go bathe and immerse yourself in the Jordan River 7 times." And so he does, and the 7th time he comes up, the leprosy's gone. So he offers Elisha all this wealth as just as a thank you for what he's done. Elisha says, "Don't need it. Fine, thank you very much, but you can take it back home with you." But Gehazi has some ideas. 2 Kings 5:19, he said to him, "Go in peace." But when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "See, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian and not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him." Bad Gehazi. This is the temptation for anyone who serves God, especially in any kind of official capacity. To go from being a servant who serves out of love for God and love for people into becoming a hireling. In other words, "Well, there's a little something for me in this. You know what? If I get the church bigger, be more tithers, which means there's more money to go around, maybe I can get myself a raise." You get the idea? We go on. Chapter 5, verse 21. So Gehazi followed Naaman, where we can tell right away this is going to be bad. So we'll go ahead and put a point right there in the bad column. And when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master," get this is what Gehazi says, "my master has sent me to say, there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of clothing." What a liar. I've got advice for you. When you meet someone who just plain old outright lies, don't try to figure out why. Honest people can never understand why a liar lies. You'll make yourself crazy trying to figure it out. I've had people look at my face and swear up and down that such and such is the case, and they were just lying and seemed real comfortable with doing it. Sometimes lying where there's nothing to be gained by lying. They just lie. I don't understand how that works. I don't get it. Don't even try to understand it. You have to be crazy to really understand a crazy person. I think you have to be a liar to understand a liar. So I guess as long as I can understand them, I have some honesty in me. Well, we go on. Scores at 5-4, okay? It's getting to be a pretty tight game. 2 Kings 5:23, and Naaman said, "Be pleased to accept 2 talents. And he urged him and tied up 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of clothing, laid them on 2 of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house." In other words, he didn't want them to get too close to the house. Elisha might see. So once they get close, they come to the hill. "Oh, don't go over there. I'll take them from here." And he puts them under his coat and sneaks on into his house. Tie game. Now how many people believe Gehazi's going to come out? Good Gehazi's going to win. Oh, I don't see any hand. Oh, one hand. I see David Saffel. He must have read ahead, huh? All right, let's see what happens. 2 Kings 5:25. "He went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, 'Where have you been, Gehazi?' And he said, 'Your servant went nowhere.'" I think we can put that over here in the bad Gehazi column. "But he said to him, 'Did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants?'" In other words, he not only sees what Gehazi took, he saw how Gehazi planned to spend it. "Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever.' So he went out from his presence a leper like snow." I don't care how high and lofty you are in God's service. It's like Spurgeon said, the seat of the mocker may be very lofty, but it's very near the gates of hell. And you know, the higher they go, the harder they fall. And so never take for granted, never assume that you can't fall flat on your face and become worse than the people you think you've come to save, to serve and to save and lead to the Lord. We need to stay humble because we could fall very easily if we take our eyes off the ball and get a little selfish. Yes, Adam, question. What's that? Okay, sure, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. It's 5 and 6 now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Good point. And you know, another thing, as you're talking, remind me, where did Gehazi first start scoring, on the good or the bad side? He started scoring over here on the good side. And I think after he built up some merits over here, he started thinking, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I don't have to be so tense about this service stuff. I can relax a little bit. And that's when the dangers come, yeah. So, all right, we have 2 more points. Let's see where they fall. 2 Kings chapter 8, we fast forward years now. 2 Kings 8, verse 1. "Now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life," who is this? The Shunammite. She comes back into the story again. 4 chapters after we think we've seen the last of her, now she appears again. "Elisha said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, 'Arise and depart with your household, sojourn wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will come upon the land for 7 years.' So the woman arose Now, isn't this similar to what happened back in 1 Kings with Elijah, with 7-year drought and famine? And the widow there, she was going to starve to death, so a miracle's work, so the flour and the oil didn't run out for the year. So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. She went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, when the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, she went to appeal to the king for her house and her land. Kind of sounds like the debtor story, Widow B. There's a connection. Now the king was talking with who? Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. Now, this is something that really makes me happy. Music. I love music in the middle of the service. That's quite all right. What makes me happy is that here's Gehazi, who now has 1 point over in the negative side of the scoreboard. He's a leper, but he's still called the servant of the man of God. Something's happened in his life. Apparently, what Elisha did had its desired effect. Because now Gehazi is sitting in the presence of the king. Lepers don't sit in the presence of the king, but Gehazi was. And what was he doing? The king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me all the great things that Elisha has done." So here we see Gehazi again in the position of one who testifies to God's mighty works. And we have a tie score. 2 Kings 8, verse 5. And while he was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, here is the woman, and here is her son, whom Elisha restored to life. There she is." And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed an official for her, saying, "Restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields, from the day that she left the land until now." We can give that point to the good Gehazi. I tell you, things were touch and go there, weren't they, for a while. But in the end, the suffering that Gehazi went through, the consequences he paid for his sin, had the desired effect. He's sitting before the king, testifying to the king about the mighty works of God, and then introducing one of the people. Here she is. She can speak for herself. What an amazing story. What an interesting character Gehazi is. And, sometimes the Bible doesn't have good guys and bad guys. It just has us guys in there. You know what I mean? And let's learn from his lesson. Let's not get comfortable when things are going well. We're starting to feel, really, I am a little holier than thou. I am. Don't let yourself get there. Stay humble. Stay obedient. Don't interfere when people are going to God, bypassing you and maybe not doing it your way. Don't start getting selfish, thinking, I do all this service for God, and what do I get? My bills are gone up, my taxes have gone up, the doctor and this and that. I got a headache and sinus, and it's time to have some me time. Well, Gehazi had some me time and got leprosy for his trouble. There's no time for me time. I bet anything after Gehazi got that leprosy, he thought, if I could just go back to just serving Elisha for free. There's a lesson to be learned here. So anyways, it's probably not the direction you expect the Bible study to go. Talk about four women that are somehow connected, but the connections are real hard to figure out. And then Gehazi. But I told you, my week kind of got a little derailed this week. In fact, would you like to see Maya? I see hands up. I'm ignoring you folks. Maya is in the house. So Josh, you bring your daughter up here? Everybody's seeing pictures. Is she sleeping? That's okay. She's pretty when she's sleeping. Now, you poor people listening on the internet, I also have to stick a picture on here for you. Oh, that's just her back. You're already going, oh. Now, the people who listen on the internet don't attend here. I've just been driving people crazy and showing everyone pictures of my granddaughter. And here she is. Hey, Maya. This is your big moment. Say hi. Get a good stretch. There you go. Scary, isn't it? You don't want to wake up to this every morning, do you? So anyways, this is Maya. This is my son, Josh. And Sarah's in the house somewhere, isn't she? Sarah, why don't you come on up, too? I want everybody to meet you. Come on, don't be shy. Here comes Mama. Do you have anything to say? Do you have anything to say to the people? It's your chance, Mama. Okay. This is our daughter-in-law, Maya. Sarah, I'm Sarah. This is Maya, this is Sarah. And Josh and Sarah met over in Abu Dhabi. Oh, she's smiling now. There she goes. There's the on switch. Yeah. See everybody? So Sarah's from Italy, and so she went back to Rome, her hometown, and that's where Maya was born. And then they went back to Abu Dhabi and then just showed up on our doorstep Monday night. And it was one of the happiest days of our lives. Okay, Maya, ready to go back and take your nap? You want to smile again? You want to smile again? Can you smile one more time? There we go. Okay. All right, I'm going to give her back. Thanks, kids. All right, you all forgot your questions now, didn't you? That's all right. Tell you what, we're going to close in prayer, and then we'll stand and have the brach. And Tim, you'll be leading us in the blessing, won't you? Our Father and King, thank you so much for your many blessings, your goodness to us. Thank you for the wonder of your word. Lord, we feel like children who are playing with diamonds and rubies, things that we cannot even begin to appreciate for value. Lord, give us insight and wisdom. And help us to be more the servant you want us to be. Help us to go through the labor pains you introduced into our life, because we know from your word that all pain is labor pain. And all labor pain brings forth life. And it brings rejoicing. So Lord, help us to embrace the pain that you ordained for us. But Father, spare us from the pain that comes through our own foolishness. But even that, too, can bring life. And we give you praise for the wonderful ways you work, for your wisdom and your grace toward us. We praise you in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.